Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. As nearly every American who has outgrown diapers must surely be aware, February is Black History Month in the USA, and has been since the nation's bicentennial in 1976. Virulent white supremacy racism that never ceases to stigmatize Black Americans as former chattel, undeserving of full and equal citizenship, makes it necessary for their recognition as equals in all things Americana. Carter Woodson, a Black scholar and educator who was a major inspiration for Black History Month more than a century ago, articulated the need for such acknowledgement. If a race has no history, he wrote, it has no worthwhile tradition in the thought of the world, and it stands in danger of being exterminated. And I follow that up with an article from Jonathan Capehart, What About Black Students' Discomfort? Of all the attempts around the country to coddle the snowflakes among us who can't handle the reality that our shared history is equal parts noble and brutal, the discomfort, quote-unquote, bill in the Florida State Legislature is the most idiotic. The official name of the legislation, part of the bonkers Stop Woke agenda of Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, is individual freedom. One of its provisions directs that classroom instruction not make any student, quote, feel discomfort, guilt, anguish, or any other form of psychological distress on account of his or her race, unquote. That protection from discomfort, of course, is a one-way street, accessible only to white students. What about the unease Black students feel learning history that is sanitized or just plain incorrect? I know I'm going back some decades, but I'll never forget the discomfort of being one of the few Black kids in a predominantly white school, especially during history classes when slavery, the Civil War, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., or the Civil Rights Movement would come up. One teacher often had students read sections of the textbook aloud in class. No one ever saw my growing alarm as I realized that the startlingly brief section on slavery would be intoned by me. I could feel the eyes on me as I read aloud paragraphs that barely scratched the surface of the inhumanity visited upon my ancestors. The Civil War was merely a costly conflict between North and South that resulted in the liberation of the slaves. And the Civil Rights Movement, in retrospect, was disgusted with its odd mix of admiration at how African Americans braved harrowing violence to push for the equality promised in the Constitution, and annoyance at how they disrupted the status quo by doing so. Mostly, though, Black people and our foundational contributions to this country were downplayed or ignored. Anyway, back to that Florida bill. While it says educators may facilitate discussions and use curricula, quote unquote, to teach about things such as slavery, racial oppression, and racial discrimination, the flawed measure includes a big old but. It says that classroom instruction and curriculum may not be used to indoctrinate or persuade students to a particular point of view inconsistent with the principles of this subsection or state academic standards, quote, unquote. Indoctrinate or persuade is a giant loophole that could potentially lead to banning anything that twinges the fragile sensibilities of those who can't handle confronting the truth or being intellectually challenged. Just how vacant this legislation and this movement are was illustrated by Tina Deskovich, a leader of the conservative group of Moms for Liberty. To say there were slaves is one thing, she told the Washington Post, but to talk in detail about how slaves were treated and with photos is another. This is the very definition of what author Robin DiAngelo calls white fragility, which she says is triggered by discomfort and anxiety, but is born of superiority and entitlement. What's happening in Florida is part of a larger and offensive national freakout over teaching the truth of our history. This past month, Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin, a Republican, issued an executive order to end the use of inherently divisive concepts, including critical race theory, which is a quote, which I might point out is not taught anywhere in Virginia public K-12 schools. During a radio interview that followed, Youngkin announced that there is even a tip line for parents to report school officials who they believe are teaching divisive, quote-unquote, subjects. Singer John Legend had the perfect response to Youngkin's nonsense. Black parents need to flood these tip lines with complaints about our history being silenced, he wrote on Twitter. We are parents also. That's who gets lost in all this, black parents and their children, all because some white people can't bear feeling uncomfortable learning about divisive subjects. They want a gauzy, feel-good version of history that blinds them to the impact such a mythology has on events unfolding now. Meanwhile, black people have to live with the real life consequences of this blissful ignorance. We'll never understand this country as long as book banning, tip lines, and legislation to bubble wrap the tender white souls among us continue to flourish. We'll just have more black kids reading more rewrites of history, wondering what was left out, and they will know their discomfort never mattered. And that was Jonathan Capehart, What About Black Students' Discomfort? And he wrote that for the Washington Post. And now, two very cogent voices of the human dialogue who have recently died, both of whom I mentioned on last week's program. The Vietnamese Buddhist priest Thich Nhat Hanh and the American radical activist Todd Gitlin, a founder of Students for a Democratic Society, the notorious SDS of not so recent yore. He knew what was important and spent the end of his life working feverishly to rally people on behalf of liberal democracy, New York Times columnist Michelle Goldberg wrote in Requiem of Gitlin. First, an essay by Nhat Hanh, who wrote it in the last half of the final century of the previous millennium, which might make it seem as ancient as Homer, yet as immediate as the armies of many nations presently girding for war this very moment. At War with Ourselves, by Thich Nhat Hanh. When President George W. Bush gave the order to attack Iraq in 1991, many of us suffered. I was at Plum Village giving a lecture, and in the middle of a sentence, I suddenly said, I don't think I will go to America this spring. I really don't want to go there now. That afternoon, a number of students from North America told me that because I felt that way, I should go. They reminded me that many Americans also suffered when the president gave the order to attack. I understand that President Bush was trying in his way to serve his people. Early in the conflict, he instituted an embargo, but he became impatient and suddenly was inevitable when he ordered the ground attack and said, "God bless America." I knew he needed our help. We have to find a way to tell the president that God cannot bless one country against another. He or she must learn to pray better than that. But we should not think that by electing another president, the situation will be transformed. If we want a better government, we have to begin by transforming the greed and violence in ourselves and working to transform society. Look at the 500,000 men and women from America and the West, and the 1 million Iraqi soldiers who spent months waiting for the land offensive of the war to begin. They had to practice killing day and night in order to prepare. They wore helmets, jumped and yelled, and plunged their bayonets into sandbags representing enemy soldiers. They had to become inhuman to learn to kill. During the night, they did the same in their dreams. This is the practice of war. 1.5 million men and women practicing fear and violence for many months. Then the war came. The actual killing was massive, and we called it a victory. When the 500,000 troops returned home, they were deeply wounded from practicing so much violence. For several generations, millions of their children and grandchildren will inherit those seeds of suffering. How can we call that a victory? 80% of the American people supported the Gulf War and called it clean and moral. They do not understand the true nature of war. The Gulf War was not clean or moral for the people of Iraq, nor for the people of the United States. After a war, many people, especially young people, see violence as the way to solve problems. The next time there is a conflict somewhere in the world, they will be tempted to support another military solution, another quick war. The death of one Iraqi soldier means that one family is suffering, and more than 100,000 Iraqi soldiers and civilians were killed. After any war, the suffering continues on both sides for several generations. Look at the suffering of the Vietnam veterans in America and the suffering of the Vietnamese people. We need to be there for those who need us, to let them know that we share their suffering. When someone feels understood, his or her suffering is diminished. Please don't forget this. We who have touched war have a duty to bring the truth about war to those who have not had a direct experience of it. We are the light at the tip of the candle. It is very hot, but it has the power to illuminate. We who were born from the war know what it is. The war is in us, but it is also in everyone. Violence has become the substance of our lives. The Vietnam veterans, the Gulf War veterans, and the millions who absorb violence every day are being trained to be exactly like those who manifest the hatred and violence that pervade our society. We water the seeds of violence in ourselves by watching violent television programs and movies that are poisoning us. If we do not transform all of this violence and misunderstanding, one day it will be our own child who is beaten or killed, or who does the beating. This is very much our affair. And that was Thich Nhat Hanh, at war with ourselves. Martin Luther King said that Thich Nhat Hanh should receive the Nobel Peace Prize. And now, Todd Gitlin, does the arc of the moral universe still bend toward justice? The left has known demoralizing, mind-bending, gut-wrenching times more than once in my lifetime. Within the space of 2 months in 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy were murdered, and with them the wild hope or the impossible dream that equality could, without much interruption, continue its onward march through the institutions of American life. Within 2 weeks in the spring of 1970, President Richard M. Nixon announced an invasion of Cambodia. Then, when millions took to the streets, National Guardsmen killed four protesters at Kent State University. 10 days later, police opened fire on a dormitory at Jackson State College, killing two black students. History didn't end, though in 1969, Attorney General John Mitchell did tell a reporter, "This country is going so far to the right, you won't recognize it." Watergate postponed that agenda. The left could count the postponement as a victory. Anyone looking for comfort today can note with satisfaction that those grievous days passed. Mitchell's prophecy was deferred. Backlashes against civil rights, feminism, and gay rights did not set us back to square one, but they were crushing. An emotional fact, if nothing else. If you were paying attention, you felt that all bets were off. Anything horrible was possible. Living in such a time takes a toll. Despair was my demon then, and I was not alone in the feeling. One gut punch after another leaves progressives reeling. We search for appropriate language. Disaster, catastrophe, calamity, or, to quote recent presidents, a thumping or a shellacking. The souls of Democrats, particularly older ones, have been tried before. The left has long since known to question any assurance that, in the words of the abolitionist Theodore Parker, as amplified by Martin Luther King Jr., the arc of the moral universe, however long, bends toward justice. The Depression years were full of stretches when the arc bent the other way, not least during the onslaughts of Hitler, Mussolini, and Franco, and the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 1939. But if you came of age after the Cold War, if you had faith in change we can believe in, how confident will you be now in the destination of that arc? Perhaps the evidence that national politics is rigged for the right reinforces the view that America was foredoomed from the days of the slave trade, that racism and nativism are unwavering, foundational, even insuperable, that Barack Obama's kind of change cannot, in the end, be believed in, that efforts to win over the moderate are silly, that confrontational moves are the only ones that feel authentic. In an emergency, they will say, incrementalism and politics, as usual, are irrelevant. With passions so high, theatrical gestures can feel like shortcuts for reaching and mobilizing the unconvinced. Even so gratifying a result as the election of a Latina Democratic Socialist organizer from the Bronx can tempt the unwary to think her model can work anywhere. It would not have prevailed against Roy Moore in Alabama's Senate election a few years back. The challenge for a left that wants to win power is existential, as well as strategic and tactical. The center is equally challenged. Can it cohabit with the left under a big tent? Not surprisingly, the words of the radical labor organizer Joe Hill, about to be executed in 1915 by the state of Utah for murders he did not commit, frequently come to mind. Don't waste any time in mourning. Organize, quote unquote. Hill's imperative may look to a skeptic like pablum and happy talk. And it's true. The time is past when optimism can be justified by naive faith. The left once felt, often foolishly, that it owned the future. Now it struggles to own a chunk of the present. Still, this is not a simple moment dangling in time, severed from the past and the future. It is not the end of days, though it may smell that way. That was, Does the Arc of the Moral Universe Still Bend Toward Justice? By Todd Gitlin, who was a professor of journalism and sociology and chair of the PhD program in communications at Columbia University, and was once head of SDS, Students for a Democratic Society. He just died a couple of weeks ago. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk engineers this program. Some years ago, a self-anointed conference on diversity published a stat sheet, The World in Perspective. If we could shrink the Earth's population to a village of precisely 100 people, with all existing human ratios remaining the same, it would look like this. There would be 57 Asians, 21 Europeans, 14 from the Western Hemisphere, North and South, and 8 Africans. 51 would be female, 49 would be male. 70 would be non-white, 30 white. 70 would be non-Christians, 30 Christian. 50% of the world's entire wealth would be in the hands of only 6 people, and all 6 would be citizens of the USA. 80 would live in substandard housing. 70 would be unable to read. 50 would suffer from malnutrition. 5 would be gay. 1 would be near death. 1 would be near birth. Only 1 would have a college education. At the time of this projection, a quarter of a century ago, at the end of the second millennium, none of those centurions, quote unquote, would possess a computer. However much the Republican Party has strived through the misanthropy of Donald Trump to attain absolute one-party rule over U.S. politics, it has from the very start imperiled its position with insolence and transparent mendacity, as well as conspicuous disregard of the Constitution, unmindful that civil and political power is in the hands of the people, for the people, and by the people, as old Abe Lincoln used to say, whom we honor along with all the other presidents on Millard Fillmore Day, February 21st, which started with Pater Nationstrom, George Washington, whose 290th birthday is the next day. If in a war you surrender to hopelessness, you most likely will die. The same for a pandemic, with the caveat that your surrender might very well recklessly infect many around you. Stay the course and endure the unendurable as long as necessary. There is indeed light at the end of the pandemia. Happy Millard Fillmore Day.